Hi, everyone. It's Dr. Denise, and this is the Dr. Denise Show, and this is the Creative Minds series, and my first guest of the series is Jay French. Jay French, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. How are you, Denise?
Oh, my goodness. You were literally my Valentine. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Oh, my goodness. So can you imagine? I wake up Valentine's Day morning. In fact, I think the text that I got was your music lyrics. It was Exotic Flowers.
Yeah, that's dope.
It's like infinity dope. And I listened to your lyrics and I was pretty much blown away. And I think it's like in synchronicity because I was like, I want to interview Jay French. And I'm going to be really honest with you. I looked at your Instagram and I listened to the song Narcissist. And then I have these intuitions. And without doing much more research, I'm like, oh my goodness, he's like perfect for like the Creative Minds series. So let me tell you why you're so perfect, because you already know who you are. But the reason why is one of my big intentions with the Dr. Denise Show is help people to change the way we think, talk, and act about mental health. And the Creative Minds series is bringing kind of a mixture of musicians, artists, people that are doing amazing things with their art to help people kind of go within and heal. And so I can't even believe it. Like I literally was getting like lightning bolt chills. And then when you sent me your bio, which we're going to, put in the show notes, I was like, oh my goodness, not only are who you are and what you've done recently, which I just can't wait, this album that I just listened to, you are a mental health advocate as well.
Right. Totally. 100%.
Yeah. So,
definitely. You know what? My advocacy goes back since, I was a kid. When I was a young kid, I had a bad stutter, right? I mean, bad. And so I went to a speech pathologist maybe twice a week from about 6 years old till I was about 14.
Wow.
Right? Every week. Think about that. That's a part of your life at that point, right? That's a normalcy, Just imagine shooting a basketball twice a week from 6 to 14. Now you're LeBron James, like I'm saying, like that's how often I seen a counselor and no one could ever do anything about it. And I had to deal with all of the childish immaturities of middle school and elementary school and high school. Just think about how often I cried or felt like my back was against the wall or felt like I wasn't worth anything, I mean, seriously, every time the teacher says, hey, it's your turn to read in school, as soon as it's my turn to read, the whole class is looking at me like, oh, here you go. And then I get to going, and it's over with. They roasted me for the rest of the day. That's how every day it was, And then my mother's a really tough love woman. So when I come back to her with the crying problems, she get out of my room with that, immediately, because she's raising four boys. She only had four boys. My mother had four boys, my mother's from Queens, New York. She lives in L.A. actually, too. Going through that, imagine what that does to someone,
Oh, no, what I do, I'm an adult and child psychiatrist. So, I mean, I wasn't you, but I will tell you right now, my son's almost 13. And for many years, up until the last 2 years, when I found the right school for him to do, adjust to his neuro style, it's a word I like. He honestly, I'm not even kidding you, Jay French. He would look at me like, Mom, you're dropping me off at prison and please bail me out. Like it was like his own battleground, like every day. Cause he knew what he was good at and what he wasn't. And it's not fun. If you were in school for that many years, it's like you had a whole nother layer of something to deal with besides any learning or and even socializing.
Right. Just think about trying to learn and you have a collar around your neck, while you're trying to take a test, just think about that. So I had to get past that early. So I conquered that, the getting past it early, which means I accepted myself as whatever they called me, you know? So I accepted myself with it. But in my mind, I'm like, I got to stop this. I want to stop this. I want to be able to talk normal. I want to be able to have a conversation like everybody else.
Do you remember like an aha moment with that? Like your moment?
No. There's no. The only aha moment I had was when I started writing lyrics. But before that,
I'm smiling.
Before that, it was sports that I got into. So I had to be the best at stuff. So I still wanted to stand out. I had this need to feel adequate. So, you know, so what gave me adequacy was playing sports. So I was in tennis when I was a little kid. I was in soccer the moment I could be in it. Play basketball every day. I had to be the best. I had to be the fastest runner. So no one could outrun me, right? So by developing all these qualities, just trying to get adequacy, after a while of doing that, you know, you look up and you're 10 years old and you're the fastest kid in the state. That's 10 years old, right? You win a state track meet. I won a state track meet, the Jim Thorpe track meet when I was 10. Not just that, I started playing football the very next year and basketball the year after. And these are the things. And I was starting always. And I was either starting or I was ineligible. You know, one of the two. But if I was on that field, I was starting, you know, on cornerback or tailback. I was so good at sports. I was so athletic. And then I ran track meets all my whole high school, middle school career. I was always the anchor leg and the relay. I was always the fastest kid in every school I went to. We moved around a lot. And this is in Oklahoma City. And I'm telling you,
I love that though, it seems like you took the energy of the frustration of the stuttering and you put the energy into the resiliency with sports and developing a champion mindset.
Right, right. So it was just like me saying, I am not going to be beat up by y'all. This is not going to happen forever. We're not going to keep doing this forever. We're definitely going to, you know, at least be great. You know, I always had a need to be like really good, and you know, and that came from being pushed over a lot and being picked on a lot. So naturally, when I'm 12 years old, you know, I'm influenced by hip hop heavy, and I was, you know, I couldn't talk, but so you know, naturally, the thing that you're least good at is the thing you want to do the most. You know,
absolutely. It's like, so you're looking in the window, like, I want that. Right. I want to get that. I want that. I want to do that.
so imagine the thing you're least good at is the thing you end up wanting to do the most was just speak fluently as a rapper. So what I did was I started writing rhymes to Lil Wayne, like Hot Boys, Juvenile, Lil Wayne's down south. Or I don't know if you know who Juvenile is, but some of your listeners.
Do you have that memorized?
I don't have any of it. Nope.
And your look, baby book.
Yeah, straight up. That was my baby book. It was my first
your
book.
Your baby book.
I don't even want to memorize it. I'm like, oh, man. But I remember like writing these lyrics. When I was 12, I started writing them into an artist named Devin the Dude. Back then, he was a real popular artist out of Houston, Texas. He was a Rap-A-Lot. And I'm not sure if you know who Pimp C is or Bun B. You know, Bun B's my guy. Shout out to him. And yay, but these guys, but literally,
these were your guys.
Like,
these were your heroes. These were
these were my
your icons.
They weren't my icons. They were just there. You know, they weren't even my heroes. Like these guys weren't like. But I was writing to their lyrics because they rapped slower. They were from Houston, Texas. They were rapping very slow and it was drawed out. They had a southern draw. And so I was starting to write to these artists. It seemed easier to rap like them. So I was like, let me just try to write. And I was by myself doing it. And then I recorded myself. And when you memorize those lyrics and take them to school and recite them in front of everybody, it's almost like doing a monologue, you know? So it's like, You don't stutter once. And this is what healed me was every day. You know, I do one in front of everybody. I muster up the courage to do this in front of everybody at the vending machines while they're beating on the vending machines. And then I get through it perfectly. And then everyone's just cheering me on because they're just happy I didn't stutter once. They're not even excited about what I said. They're just like, man, you didn't stutter one time. So it was goodness. Like all my friends was gathered around. The ones that picked on me were gathered around. They just like, man, this is crazy. So that, of course, with that self-esteem and that, you know, and that ego blow up right there, I went home and wrote another one. And the next day I'm doing the same thing. Then I wrote another one. And this became a thing until now. Do you understand? This is from when I was 12. Now, by the time I'm 15 years old, the stutter's gone.
Yes. Woo. Wow.
I healed myself, right? I healed myself through this. And that's, I play a lot of instruments. I played instruments from the time I was like 6 years old, maybe before that. Before that, I played drums and percussion instruments before that. But I started in violin. I was in piano. I was a trumpet player. I was cello. Yeah. So, you know, these things, you know, I was so good at, you know, people ask me like, why rap? When you play all these other instruments, why rap?
Why rap?
And I'm like, because it healed me. It's my savior. Like, why would I abandon it when, you know, it's attached to me like an arm or like a leg.
I was just thinking it's like integrated within you.
Yeah.
It's like a part of your soul.
Yeah. And so I can't abandon it. And then on top of it, like, I don't write anymore. I went from writing these to I don't even write anymore, right? And through hip hop and through performance art, I became I found a pathology. I found my pathology through that, and I suggest that to everyone who knows a kid who has a stutter or who even has one to take either drama or write poetry that they can recite in front of people at a rhythm. So these things are like, or do like stand-up comedy or something, you know, because you're speaking out of rhythm and you'll find your pathology through speaking out of rhythm over and over and over and over. You know, it made me a better speaker.
I love this.
And now today,
I love this.
I don't think anybody could outspeak me today. and I'm not even trying to be braggadocious. I'm just saying that's how great I am at speaking is, you know, I went from not even being able to complete a sentence to, you know, actually feeling like I'm the best in my field at what I do, in rap. So,
you know, I want to get to this rap, but I want to go back and think about you, you know, developmentally. I'm an adult and child psychiatrist, and I've helped, you know, my sister's a speech pathologist, and I've worked with people that have had stuttering. And what I was just thinking that I had my own awareness is not only were you every day going to school with that stutter, which I've had that with helping others, but as you're explaining this and saying how you've sort of ascended from your own crisis to thrive with stuttering now to rapping, and we're going to get to the recent successes, but I was thinking about how mindfully aware and how much you were there in the moment, but you had to be outside of yourself watching yourself and observing. So it's like you were there, but then it just, right when you started healing yourself through rap, it's like you had this like almost like rapid fire healing ascension. It's like something clicked that words can't really describe. Oh, it looks like you're muted.
Hold on. You can't really share joy. You know, these things are like, you know, the rapid fire moment happens to everybody when they do something great. And you can't even describe it. Like when you're about to do something great, you can't tell anyone, hey, I'm about to do this. And it's so great. Like, you can't even express it. And like, I can tell you right now, I'm going to shoot this hoop from the 3-point line and I'm going to make it right now. And chances are I might miss it just because I told you I was going to make it. But if I was just focused on it, and just had an idea, like, maybe I can shoot it like this every time and I might hit those things, you know? So it's like, you know, when it comes to doing anything great and accomplishing anything, there's a focus that you have to have and a drive. And this is what I admire about like athletes and about anyone, artists that do great things. You can't really share it. You can't really tell everybody what you're doing before you do it. I had no idea when I came back to speech class when I was 15, they were like, you do not need us anymore, sir.
Oh, you got this.
I came back over after summer break in 10th grade. They were like, yeah, you're through. You don't need this anymore. And I mean, we shook hands and went our separate way, you know, and it was just like, you know, it took a while, but I got to that point to where it was just like the pathology was there. And
I love it. So have you done camps for kids, or have you done any children's books or anything with parents? Because I feel like, oh my goodness, I could see like a whole group of parents with their kids just wanting to listen to your story. Has that ever evolved? I know, you know, you're like, I can't wait to talk about your recent album, but I'm thinking, has this happened yet?
No, I haven't done anything like that, but I'll tell you what I do do.
Mm-hmm.
I do help people in real time without being an organization, or I do help people in real time. I meet people all the time and I take them in and they can't even believe, like, they're like, why? And it may be a chick that wants to date me or something. I'm like, and she, you know, you can come around, and she comes around and I end up helping her in life. Like, I never get someone around me that I don't help with something. You know, I'm always going to be an asset to people. So that's the way I am. Because when I was young, I had people who weren't, I didn't have a lot of people who were assets to my life. So that's what I strive to be to every single person in my life. I don't care who it is. My next door neighbor, I don't even celebrate Christmas. I grew up like Jewish kind of, you know, like I didn't really grow up. I never even experienced a Christmas tree in the house. And I cook Christmas gifts for people, cook Christmas candy and cookies and stuff for my neighbors. And they're like, thank you, you know. And they'll make me some too, and I won't even eat them. I'm like, I didn't want that. I don't celebrate Christmas, but I made this because I want y'all to understand that you guys are important, that you guys are important to somebody. If you don't have a friend, you got me, you know. And they always appreciate it. Some of them cry and stuff. Like, it's crazy. Like, you know, and, you know, that's how I always operate and function in life, is just to always help everyone. And so
I as you're speaking, I'm putting my hand on my heart. So I'm just feeling like the heart energy and like the love, like it's all about love, and you want people to win. Like it's like you want to have people be their own best friend, but you want to be their best friend in the moment too.
Right. Right. You know, I just want people to feel like if you have a team around you, and I've learned that in this industry for sure, that if your teammates, if you just go around scoring every bucket, right? Let's say LeBron James just scores every bucket and never passes the ball. His team will end up falling apart. Even though he's scoring 100 points a night, his team will fall apart because they're feeling inadequate, you know? And the last thing you want is for your teammates or people around you to feel less than confident, because that's how people get, that's how thievery happens, is from someone feeling like they need something that you have. And, you know,
less than, the scarcity mindset.
Yeah, that's how haters, that's how your best friend turns into a hater, like, because you're not empowering them, you know. And that's the one thing you have to do, is empower everyone around you. And when you empower everyone around you, they'll empower you, you know. That's the way it works.
So one thing I want to say is, you know, one of the things I'm passionate about is like creativity fuels the soul, and your whole like description and your childhood is that. And now you're talking about the power of words, thoughts, and actions. And, you know, we're just talking about the word hater. And I just listened to your whole album just before our interview tonight. And so much of your messaging, I don't know if you want to start with this album or take us on your music journey, because it is about words, thoughts, and actions, and lyrics and rap, and just really kind of being like at one with your like happiness and higher self.
Yeah.
So I'm just really touched by that. And I'm wondering if like, is that how your journey started in the music? I know your journey started through your lyrics that you just shared. How did that evolve into your music career?
I mean, I've been doing, you know, I started with battle rap when I was a teenager, when I was like 15, 16, I started battle rapping. And I used to just write battles. So I went right, you know, I'm a bold guy. Like I go right into the top stuff. Like I'm like, I go into the hardest part. Like that's the one, that's, I like to take the long route when I come home. Like I'm that guy, you know, I don't mind. You know, I will jump head over heels into a relationship. I don't care. I'm with mm-hmm. it. We have one life to live. So I'm like, why not go furthest I can go? So I went right into the, I learned that I could rap. And then I went into the hardest segment of rap, which is battling with rap.
And, oh, I love it.
So I succeeded there. I never got beat once. I swear to God on my life. And
wow.
From that point.
Where was your first battle rap at? Can you remember? Can you take
Tulsa,
us there?
Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm from Oklahoma City, but it was in Tulsa, my first one.
And do you remember who it was against?
Or hell no. I don't even remember names. Tulsa. It was so many people. It was so many guys. I was like Eminem on 8 Mile.
Can you do me a favor? What's so ironic is that you're not even going to believe this. This is a shut the front door. So not only did I spontaneously call you because you were like essentially my Valentine. Like I literally woke up to hearing you sing. Someone sent me your song. I'm like, I want to interview Jay French. And so I just was kind of bold like you. Cause you know what I mean? I'm like, and this morning, my son, I just want you to know he has always had some learning challenges. And now, you know, his self-esteem, he actually has written song lyrics. He loves rap. In fact, I got him the History of Rap book. And this morning you just mentioned Eminem. He had me listen to Eminem's powerful words about addiction. So I integrated on our way to school. We always listen to his music and I always use it as this like aha moments to connect with him. So I find it so incredibly fun that not only did I start my day listening to rap and talking with my son, now I get to talk with you. And I'm interested in how did that whole battle rap, like, did you hear so-and-so was like, where did you meet? Can you just take us on that journey at that age?
I honestly got in trouble at school because I was late all the time because I had problems at home. I had home problems. I ran away from school at 15 years old. I mean, not school, from home. I ran away from home at 15 years old. And at the age of 15, you don't know what the hell to do. I'm sleeping on people's couches. I'm charming everyone's parents. They're letting me sleep at their house and, you know, all my friends. So I'm moving around a lot. And my mother says, hey, man, we sending you to Job Corps, you know, and I was like, I ran from them. They tried to send me to boot camp. I ran from that. They couldn't find me. And I was still going to school. That's the crazy part. I was still attending school the whole time.
Oh, good for you.
I had a job and everything. But they were like, we're going to send you to, I was working at Sonic. My first job was at Sonic.
And oh, my goodness.
So I'm working at Sonic and I'm the hookup for the school on Friday. And everybody goes to the mall, you know, everyone goes to the mall. I'm like, hey, Jamal, let me get that. I'm like, I got you, fam. You know, I'm the hook. I got fired for hooking everybody up. And then my dad wasn't really around. My dad is a four-time Grammy winning percussionist. Now, his name is Brother Noom. Mm-hmm. And that's my father. He wasn't around me growing up at all, like at all. So I maybe seen him like twice a year, you know, and when he comes in town or whatever. He's from Oklahoma City, but he moved to New York when I was like 8 years old. And to pursue his career, you know, and but so he missed a lot when it came to us, and he had a lot of kids, and but he had 16 kids, by the way, and wow. So I have a lot of siblings, yeah. But my mother, she's just like, we need to get a grip on this guy, so she sent me to Job Corps, and I agreed to it at one point. You know, I ran from him for a while, then it just got hard out there. I was about 16, and I agreed to it, and I went to Job Corps. And it's like a, you know what Job Corps is? It's like a trade school, you know, type thing.
Yes, they have it here. Yep. But it's not called that. I'm just like, yeah, I know exactly.
Yeah, just a trade school that you go live on campus and all that stuff. So she sent me up to Tulsa. And meanwhile, even though I'm home, I'm moving around, I'm house hopping and stuff at that age, and with a job and in school, I'm writing every day still. You know, I never got off that. That was the thing that was just instilled in me to do. And so I go to Job Corps and I'm rapping on campus. I make friends and I'm rapping on campus. And everybody's like, go to Jay. Oh, you can rap? We're going to bring you over here to battle Jay French. You know, this is when I first got that name, Jay French, you know.
Tell the story. How did that all transpire?
Well, your name? My name is Jamal French. but that's my real name. But my name, but I had my name changed that year because I wanted to get my license. So my mother's name is French, and my dad's original last name is Williams. And so I was a Williams before, you know, all my life. Everyone knew me as Jamal Williams growing up in school and all that stuff. So I had my name changed that year to French. And then I just started going by Jay
French.
Can I ask
your mom's first name? What's your mom's first name?
Catherine?
Mm-hmm. Shout out to Catherine. It's a lot raising, being a single mom, right?
Four boys, yeah.
Yeah, shout out to all single moms. I'm a single mom. I'm giving myself a shout out too.
Yeah, yeah.
No, you know, but it's a bit, but it's a very realistic, it's a big deal. And all that male energy, you know? Yeah. Okay, so then you were, so it just transpired. You just were evolving. And then when did it go professional? What's your story? What was the bridge?
The bridge to what?
How did you go from the battling to starting to do your albums? How did this progress?
The battling happened. I started battling in Job Corps, and then I started going everywhere else and battling, like Austin and in different places and battling. And after a while, I mean, just battling, you know, with rhymes and doing all kind of stuff everywhere I went. You know, whoever rapped, you know, it was a street thing. So whoever rapped, we just meet up and battle. That's just the way it was in the streets. I'm from the bottom. You know, I grew up around hood guys and stuff, and in the worst parts of the country, the worst parts of the cities, of every city I was in. Like, that's just, you know, what you're subjected to when you don't have enough confidence and enough mentors around you to tell you to do something different, to show you something different. My mother was a single mother. She struggled with that because she's got four boys. And women can't, it's hard for a woman to raise a boy. It's almost impossible, you know? So it's, you know, because women won't push the boy in the pool, you know, and say, swim, you know? Women won't push the boy in the pool and say, swim. A man will. A man will push the boy right in the pool, in the deep end. Swim, learn how to swim.
I love
the mother's
what you're
like,
saying.
Put your foot in the water, put your toe in the water. You know, that women are nurturers. So they don't want to hurt, they want to comfort a child, and men want to push the child out of their comfort zone, just the opposite. So it's, you know, we didn't have, I had men around, but I didn't have my father around. So I had men around, so they would do it when they were around me, and it would feel very abusive, even though they had the best intentions, you know? And I learned now, like I still talk to these men. My Uncle Sky, I call him Uncle Sky, and my godfather, Ricky, these guys raised me, you know? So they ended up, you know, teaching me everything I needed to know about everything. So it was like, about everything, about being a man, about what it takes to be a man, about what a real man does. They taught me how to cut grass. I was cutting grass when I was 10, you know? They taught me how to do everything, you know? So, you know, after a while, you know, you just develop this kind of, you know, you're battle rapping, you're moving around doing everything, you're in the streets like that. And then one day it just clicked that I wanted to make music instead of just battle rap. And maybe I was about 16 years old, 17 years old. And then when I was about 17, I started writing songs. And that's how long I've been writing songs. You know, I was already proficient when it came to rapping and doing poetry and stuff like that. But when it came to writing hooks and making this stuff actually make sense, and then, you know, putting your heart into it, that happened about 17 years old, about 18 was my maturity. And I moved to Austin, Texas when I was 18. The moment I became an adult, bought myself a car. My whole 17-year-old year, I was homeless that whole year. I got kicked out of Job Corps for fighting over battle rapping, literally fighting over a battle that I won. And I dissed the guy so much, he didn't like me. So, you know, he swung off on me, and we got kicked out. And
you were homeless where? Which town?
I was homeless in Oklahoma City.
Wow. I bet you have so many stories about that.
Oh, man, here. I was sleeping in vacant apartments. I had three jobs. I had a girlfriend. I didn't even tell her what was going on. I didn't even tell her. She didn't even know I was homeless. She thought I was staying at one of my friend's houses, a different friend's house. I didn't have a car. She was picking me up from different people's houses.
Wow.
And then I saved up enough money that I was giving my Uncle Ricky, my godfather Ricky, I was giving him all my checks. And I would give him all my checks. And I had three jobs consistently for a year, three jobs. And but I was homeless though. So because I was just like, I want to make it on my own. I want to do this myself. I don't want to. So I would sleep in like vacant apartments and stuff. I would go through the window of a vacant apartment. I could spot a vacant apartment from a mile away. You know, there, that place right there. I'm going to go in there. So I would sleep in there, wake up, you know, go next door as if I was the neighbor, the people's neighbor. They all liked me. They were like, they thought I was cute. And, you know, everyone thought I was a handsome guy. I look, you know, they were like, I got a backpack on. They think I'm going to school or something. They're like, I'm just like, can I use you guys?
Oh, so you kind of look super polished.
Yeah, I was polished as
heck. Like a very polished homeless. You
kidding me? Person. I was like stealing clothes every day from Dillard's. I was not playing around. I was like, I'm trying to get it.
We actually do a pause right now and honor the concept? This, you know, we're talking about it and you're here, but there's so many people that are homeless and are in poverty. And I feel very strongly that, you know, we've got 7.8 billion people on the planet. And I do think that we can do better. You know, I think I'm not against the concept of, you know, people being successful, but I think a lot more philanthropy and altruism needs to happen because there's some people that have, you know what I'm saying? So how do you feel about that? Have you, that time in your life when you were homeless, is that do you have a special place in your heart with some of the work you're doing now? Or
no,
how has that influenced you?
I don't. I'm just kidding. No,
well, no, you see you. Be authentically you. If you don't, you don't.
I'm just kidding. I have a special place in my heart for a human being.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
It's hard just being a human being, even if you're rich. It's hard just being a human being altogether. It's just not easy for anyone. It's not like, you know, I see a homeless person and I'm like, man, I need to help them. I'm like, no, I need to introduce them to something or just say hi to them correctly today so they can feel like someone noticed them. You know, right. I don't want to go up and talk to homeless people all day. That's not what I want to do. I don't even want to associate myself with anyone that's homeless because I've been homeless and I know what it feels like. And I'm like, I'm not the guy you need to talk to. You need to go talk to a counselor. You need to go talk to your mom. You need to go apologize to your auntie who you just broke a window yesterday. You need to go apologize to your ex-girlfriend. You need to get some forgiveness in your heart. And then you need to get some you get rid of your resentment and forgive everybody. And that's what's going to connect you with everybody. You can't go to sleep with resentment in your heart anyway. You're not going to sleep right. You're not going to get rest. You'll fall asleep, but you're not going to be rested if you resent people and have hatred in your heart and stuff like that. It doesn't matter if you're homeless or if you, like some people who are homeless want to be homeless. They don't want you to save them. You know, they're going to take that money you give them and go buy drugs with it. They're going to take that money you give them and go. I'm not saying don't give them money if you just feel like giving them some money, because I might give them some money. You know, tomorrow, I might see somebody tomorrow and be like, take this 20, man. You know, but.
So how did you get out of your homelessness? Tell us about this ascension path and everything you've been up to. Because you've got some cool news for us, too.
I worked. I worked a job. I kept working. I was making it to my jobs by any means necessary. I had a girlfriend who was willing to come pick me up every day. She was a spoiled kid, you know, spoiled kid. And she had a car, a nice car too, like a drop top. We're like 17, you know, she's got like this brand new Spider Eclipse with the kit, racing kit on it with rims on. And I'm in her car, whatever. She's coming to pick me up every day. I'm lying to her, telling her, yeah, my homeboy stays here. You know, I'm just, you know, come pick me up from my homeboy's house. This is the address. And I'll be outside waiting on her. Boom. She'll pick me up, take me to this job. Then I'll walk to this other job. And then I'll take a bus to this other job. Or I'll call another friend to come pick me up and take me over there. But when you're going to work, anyone will pick you up and take you to work, you know? So it was like, I was just going to work. And I was working at Nothing But Noodles, a place called Nothing But Noodles, P.F. Chang's. And I was washing dishes at P.F. Chang's, washing dishes at Nothing But Noodles. And then I started doing prep cooking there. I'm 17. And I'm what they call black in America, you know? So imagine the stuff I'm going through mentally and stuff. And then I worked at a place called Vision Quest, which is a telemarketing company. So I was doing telemarketing P.F. Chang's, washing dishes, nothing but noodles, washing dishes every day. I wash dishes at nothing but noodles at night, wash dishes at P.F. Chang's in the morning, and then throughout the day, I'm working at Vision Quest for six hours.
I will tell you, my very first job at age 15 was at a place called Skip's Pizza in Schaumburg, Illinois. I grew up in the suburbs, and I was washing dishes. And I not only was washing dishes, Skip would only give us the burnt pizza, Jay French. He would not even give us, like, you know, like a full pizza. So I wasn't working three jobs.
You had to pay for that pizza. He's like, hey,
yeah,
give me $10, fam.
He would only give us the burnt pizza. And I remember thinking it motivated me so much because I did babysitting. I was a lifeguard, and I did pay for my own professional education. But I think hard work, I want to keep carrying your journey. But I think that those, for me personally, I remember thinking as I was washing those dishes and being offered the burnt pizza only, that this is not what I was getting. You know what I mean? It was good. Right. It was good because there was money, but I thought it built some character, you know?
Yeah,
I think my parents were happy that I was wanting to earn my own money. But your situation, you were scrapping. You were doing everything you could.
Are you kidding me? Scrapping is an understatement. I was literally like, out of energy every day. Like, I didn't have a day that I could just be like, okay, everything's chill. Let's just go. Let me just party. I never partied. To this day, I don't party. It's not part of my ethnic code. I don't party. I don't vacay. I don't do any of that. I'm a worker. I'm a workhorse. Like, that's what I do. I go to work. I train myself to go to work no matter what is going on. So, three jobs at 17 the whole year. Save up enough money. I bought my first car when I was 17 for $150, right?
$150. Oh my goodness, what was your first car?
Dollars. It was an Oldsmobile 86. It lasted me 3 weeks. It ran for 3 weeks. And it was the raggediest car in the world. But I was pushing that thing like it was a Benz or something. And I'm telling you, I was riding and it just broke down one day. On the side of the road, I had to be at work in like 15 minutes. I was like, I'm walking to work. I'm leaving this right here. I walked all the way to work and and stayed at work. I left work. That thing was picked up from the side of the highway. And the tow truck, I guess, towed it. The city towed it away. So I'm going through all of this. And then by the time I'm 18 years old, I'm plotting my escape out of the city. And I moved to Austin, Texas when I was 18. The moment I turned 18, I went and bought me a car for my birthday present. That was my birthday present to myself.
I love that.
A brand new car. And I had enough money stacked up. I moved to Austin. I had enough money in the bank. The whole time I was homeless, I was still recording mixtapes.
That's what I was going to ask you.
I was recording mixtapes the entire time. I had a guy named Taylor Made from Dallas, Texas. He was up in
Oklahoma. Shout out to Taylor, right?
Yeah, Taylor Made, man. That guy. He was charged me $25 an hour to record these mixtapes I was doing. And then this other guy did the screwed up version and chopped and so I printed up so many CDs. I found a guy that could print up CDs. He printed up so many CDs and I had these bootleg looking CDs, but they bumped. You put them in your CD player, they bang. And I moved to Austin and I'm standing outside Exxon for 3 months selling all these CDs. I sold like 150 CDs, right?
Oh, wow.
A guy walks up to me, approaches me. His name is Tim. He says, hey, have you ever sold cars? I said, nah, man. And he said, come in Monday if you want to. He gave me his card, said, come up here, come up to the lot Monday. He worked for Volkswagen at Automax. I go to Automax on Sunday. I go to Walmart. I'm in Austin. I don't know anybody. I was bored every day. I didn't know anybody. And I'm living out of my car, you know. And I'm living with my friend, with my ex's sister at the time, like in my car at the same time, you know. And I got clothes there, but I don't really like being there, you know, type thing. And so I started at the car lot that Monday. On Sunday I go to Walmart and put on some clothes and buy some Walmart clothes, but I wore them so nicely and I had some cologne and I sprayed it on and I wore it so nice. Got my hair cut. I looked so great. You would have thought I came straight out of a JCPenney's magazine, you know, and I go to the car lot Monday. They're like, yeah, when do you want to start? I'm like, I'll start today if you want me to. They put me in training that day. I was in training for two weeks. And then I started that car lot and man, never looked back. That's the only job I ever worked since. And I haven't worked since like 2015. Mm-hmm. That was the last job I had was 2015 and it was the car lot. But yeah, I started selling drugs that year. I got introduced to the drug game that year.
Which year?
In 2005. Okay. 2006, I'm sorry, 2006. This is in Austin, Texas. Then I moved to Killeen. And I was in Killeen doing a lot of stuff, just selling crack, literally selling crack, cooking up crack was in the street. I started seeing so much money from that. It was ridiculous. I was in the streets by 2009 or 10. I go to prison. I got locked up. I went to prison. This whole time I'm making music and everything.
Which prison did you go to?
In Oklahoma City. I went back to Oklahoma City, just transporting stuff. And got caught up. Mm-hmm. Got snitched on by like my best friend. And he got caught up and he ratted me out type thing, you know. So I go and do the time and just fess up to it. And at the time I'm like 22, something like that. 22, 23, so I forget the age. But I'm at that age. I'm in my early 20s. I go to prison. I did 4 years in prison.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I did 4 years in prison. A lot of things happened in between that. Of course, the streets are crazy. My little brother got shot in the car with me. He survived, but he got shot in the car with me in my passenger seat while I'm getting robbed. You know, goodness. Drug dealers robbed each other. Yeah. He's good now. Okay. But I'm saying like back then it was so crazy. It gave me paranoia. It gave me anxiety after that, you know. So I go to prison and I heal myself in prison while I'm there. I read a lot of stuff. I stayed, you know, I started college when I went to prison, I started in college. While I was there, they let me go to college.
That's awesome.
And when I got out, I went to OSU. Yeah, when I got out, I went to OSU.
Did you get out in 2014?
I got out in 2013. I went in 2009 to 2013.
So how far along were you in college in prison?
I got to the point I had like 21 credits left in school when I got out.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you used the time for that. Because how many people do you see not do that during prison?
It was me and one other guy in prison that was in college.
That's what I was thinking.
It was an Asian guy. We called him Samurai, Asian guy.
So just so you know, you and I just met today and we talked a bit before we did the show, but I've actually worked in maximum security prisons as a psychiatrist. And so I don't have it, you know, I have it from a different perspective. I was working at Corcoran where I had to wear like the spit shield and the three strikes and I was on the prison yards. And, you know, I learned a lot just from the short time I was there, but I was not privy to meeting anyone who was as determined as you.
Yeah.
So that's really good myth buster that, I mean, you kind of like, wow, you really used that time wisely.
Yeah. I just treated it like it was college. I was like, I'm away for college for 4 years. I'm away for college.
That was the silver lining of going to prison? I mean, it sure sounds like it. I would never even
just being able to sit still. Like up to that time, I was always on the hustle. I never got a chance.
You had food, shelter, and clothing too. I mean,
right. So I never got a chance to sit still with myself and think and be, you know, and just sit down and not worry about paying bills or worry about hustling or where. So in prison, I didn't do anything but draw pictures. Oh, not to mention when I was in ninth grade, I was a child prodigy with art and paint, and I got nominated for a Who's Who Award and everything. And I had a class by myself where I did all the art for the school. And I got that everything happened to me by getting in trouble. Like I was in detention and I drew my hand and I left it there and the principal found it and called me in the office the next day and said, did you draw this? And I was like, yeah, I drew that. I just drew my hand. It's my first time ever doing it. And with the shading and everything. And he said, would you mind drawing a Martin Luther King for me? And this is a white guy, it's a principal. And I was like, no problem. I don't know if I could do it, but I'll try. And he said, I'm gonna put you in class with Miss Dearborn. And then they made my mom sign a thing. This is when I was 14. That they made my mom sign a whatchamacallit, a way, a consent thing to let me have that class by myself. And I had the class alone. I just did the art for the school for first hour every day. That was my first hour every day was me just doing art for the whole entire school.
I love that.
And so I had that background. So in prison, I started drawing again. I picked the pencil up. I'm drawing pictures for everybody's kids and wives and girlfriends who were out there visiting them and stuff. And I'm drawing them pictures of them. They give me a picture. I draw it for them. That's what I did the whole time I was there. And I worked out and I read a lot of books, like thousands of books. And then I went to college the entire time I was in prison.
Oh my goodness. I love this story. I love it. Like, I'm like here talking with you and it's just such an honor. So you finished the prison time. You were almost done with college. What was your major or what did you
My major with? Was sociology.
Okay. Awesome.
Sociology. And I ended up changing my major to marketing.
Okay.
And it started a whole nother direction. So, and then I ended up, that was what I ended up graduating for, was marketing from OSU.
So then take us to, wow, you and I could do like three more shows.
I know, it's already been an hour.
I know. I'm just having fun with you. So.
Well, so you asked the story, so I'm giving you.
I
some
love
of
the
it.
Story, and I mean,
and I'm skipping a lot of stuff.
I know you are. I know you are.
Like this could, you know, and I wrote a book, and I have a book coming out this year called Unreasonably Smart, and that still, it that book's not about me. The book's about everyone else. You know, other people, case studies, and putting them together. It's a study. It's a research book. It was just a case study book, you know? And so it's a book I want to see in colleges one day because it's really good. It took a lot of research to make it. And
well, I'm excited. I want to read it. And then I want to have you back to talk about that. So can we talk about your music, music right now? I'm like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Like,
good karma. Good karma comes from a deep place, man.
Tell us about Good Karma. I just listened to the whole album. Man, I woke up. Yeah, tell us.
This is the album. It took my whole career to make this album so far. And everything I've been through in my career, my trust issues from being in the streets to being in the industry to everything else. And I had to find like the most. I got a therapist for the first time in my life while I was making this album right before I made it. To make sure my heart and mind was in the right place while I was making this, because I had the best idea to make something that was just called, the album was called Made from Love first. And then it ended up being called Good Karma. I had three albums that came out before this album, Jag, OGB, OGB 1.5, like the remix to it. And then my first album, Jaguar Jesus in 2016, 2017, 18, 19, 2020, Jag comes out, and then 21, I start on Good Karma in the beginning of the year. And independent, 100% independent, have dealt with labels, have been around everybody, dated celebrities. Like, you know, I dated Badu's sister for like a year and a half, and she ended up stealing like 10 grand from me, you know. And this is right before I started making Good Karma. So I was having just trust issues with people close to me and stuff. So I had to forgive everybody. And get rid of it and put it behind me and get up the next day and be great again, right? So, and go for greatness and go for my goals. And good karma is just about what you give, right? Good karma comes from what you give, not what you get. It comes from how much you give. So good karma is just about how much I gave, how much I had to give to get something. That was, I mean, how much I had to give you on this album in order for you to like it. So, you know, if we give something, if you package something up and give it away correctly, people will receive it correctly. That's the way it works. You know, good karma sounds like just me. I'm not sound like Jay-Z or like Lil Wayne or like Drake or like Kanye. No one. I sound like me. I'm giving you, I had to go deep inside of me and dig deep inside and pull out the biggest champion I could to get past my problems in order to be inspired and to be creative. And what came out of it was like the effort that I put in it is what you hear when you listen to it. You know, the effort of me being in a dark place and finding my way out of it, you know. It was so dark, you had to like, I had to feel my way out of a dark place. You know, went and got a therapist, everything I could do.
Tell me about that. When did you make that decision? How did you know that that, what, but was that right when you felt like there was so much betrayal? Was that what inspired it?
I was having trust issues really bad. I couldn't trust anybody in my mind. I didn't want to go anywhere with anyone. I didn't want to be around really anymore. I was like, I don't like how I feel. So let me get a therapist just here, just so I can, I diagnosed myself. Like, you know, I came up with it myself. I'm very self-aware, you know? So I was like, I'm not trusting anybody. I don't like feeling like this. So from that point, I was like, let me get a therapist. I'm going to start fasting. I'm going to start running every day again. So I fasted for like 7 months. I lived like a monk. I didn't curse one time. That's why you hear no cursing in the album. And I didn't curse once. I cleaned my mind. I cleaned my mouth. I cleaned my eyes. I cleaned my ears. Right. So my diet was good. Everything I was taking in was positive. That was it. And your diet is the diet of your eyes and ears is way more important than the diet of your mouth, even though your mouth diet is important too. But the diet of your eye, you can't regurgitate what you put in your eyes and ears. You know, you can regurgitate what you put in your mouth. You can throw that up. If it's not good for your body will reject it. Your mind and your eyes and your ears, that's going straight into your head, into your brain, into your psyche. And you can't throw that up when it's not good for you. You know what I'm saying? And you can't unsee stuff and unhear stuff. So it's really important that you make sure you're taking in healthy things with your eyes and ears. So
So can I just geek out a little bit? So
please. First of all, this is your field. This is your field.
No, but I just want to compliment you. You literally like access your higher level of awareness. And there's a term called epigenetics, where essentially we can turn on our optimal health and well-being. And we used to think it was more 50-50, you know, our biology and our DNA, but so much of our environmental choices. So it sounds like you wanted to travel outside of yourself. Look at your whole life and know your talents, but you said, wait, I want to do this in a different way. And so when you're talking about the unseeing, taking in healthy things, you know, I have another series called On Staying Sane, and we talk about mindful ingestion of the news, but it's mindful ingestion of everything, your nutrition, your health, your what you read, who you hang out with, the words you say, and paying attention. And I just listened to your entire album before the interview, and I want to listen to it again. In fact, even better, I wish I was listening with you and I, where we would listen to a song and then just break it down.
Well, we can set that up.
It was so powerful. And you also, when I was reading about it, when you did this album, you did it freestyle?
Yeah, I did. I freestyled every track. I didn't write one word in the whole album.
Oh my goodness. Can you just tell us about that artistic process of, and like, I mean, and then also you had so many different instruments, and was it the same vocalist throughout? I mean, it was like, wow. Mm-mm.
Every song's got different people on it in the background. Like if you hear a singer on Losses, that's a guy named Danny. He's playing the sax on that song too. Another guy named Vincent Arnold is the one that produced that song, that beat. And then I just reproduced it and made it bigger and put the sax in it and did all this stuff. And I Quincy Jones'd my own album, Staunch. I kind of wrote out the piano part on it. You know, my guy Martin Morgan is the one that played the piano throughout that whole track on Staunch. Same thing on Breakfast. He played the piano pretty much on every single track. And then, but I'm making the beats and stuff and putting things together. And I had a couple producers. But a guy named Mark Christopher Lawrence, he's on the first track on Breakfast doing a speech. Dude's amazing. He's just a great actor. He's been in everything from Terminator 3 to Chucky to you name it. I think he was on Fresh Prince and Martin and Seinfeld. He's on Seinfeld twice. He's on Chuck, the show Chuck. He's on so many, you know, so many. He's on Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith. this guy, he did it for free. You know, we just bonded in San Diego, and he just did it for free for me. You know, he just got up there and he wrote the speech out himself and did it at the end of Breakfast, the first song.
Wow.
And he was really feeling the song and feeling the vibe and the energy that I had then, you know, when I was in the middle of making that album. And it took about 40 songs to come up with those 10 that's on the album. I did 40 songs.
Wow.
Back to 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 back. And then I finally found the sound of this album. And then I made the next 10 songs I made was the songs on that album. So I was in rhythm, you know.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
As you were doing it and creating it, and then how did you determine the order? Is that just, I mean, it's kind of cool, right? You started with Breakfast, right?
Right, right.
Then you've got Staunch. Exotic Flowers is what I woke up to. And that's, I love your, like the video, that the music lyric video.
Oh yeah, lyric video. Yeah, it's really cool. It's a really cool video.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we found out something when we were talking before, that you're so passionate about soul, vibrational frequency. And I think it's kind of a great timing with it. You know, I think that there should be All History Month, but you had a big, profound TikTok video that came out. Can you just comment on that? And
yeah,
just the, like how you're using your voice and your vibe in so many ways.
Yeah. I did a bunch. I posted a video of me doing a song called Black and White that I made. Don't call me black no more. Call me American. Don't call me white no more. I'm saying like that on purpose because, you know, I just wanted to be more relative to the way people talk in real life. So I didn't say don't call me black anymore. Don't call me white anymore. You know, so I went into making this song based on a conversation I used to have like every night with a girl named Deborah Vink in Amsterdam and in 2017 and 18. And she told me about how they don't call each other black and white over there. They don't even have a word that they call each other that's even kind of, you know, relative to that word at all, or even synonymous with black or white. They call each other Dutch. And they respect each other like that. And I was thinking, like, just years before I even made the song, like, man, I'm just tired of being called black and calling people white. Like, you know, and then I look it up. Of course, sociology was my major for a long time. Right. And I look it up. And of course, you can't find out how many black people or white people exist anywhere but in this country. Because no one represents themselves as that. No one refers to each other as that anywhere but here on paper. You see, they might say that because they're trying to fit in with us, but they don't refer to each other as that on paper. We do. We're like a black guy, white guy, short, you know, whatever, you know, when we're referring to someone in Amsterdam and Germany and anywhere else in Africa, they don't even refer to each other as that. They call each other by their ethnicity. And that's Dutch or Nigerian or Egyptian or Moroccan, British, German, whatever, you Polish. You know, they never say a Polish black guy or a black Polish guy in Poland. They don't say that, you know. And so they call each other. They have a word in Amsterdam for dark skinned, for light, mm-hmm. fair skinned. They have, you know, or skinned, dark skinned or fair skinned. They have words for those terms. They don't have words.
You and I had that resonance before we spoke because I was. Yes. Explaining to you, not even knowing that this was a TikTok passion of yours, was that I'm an adoptive mom. And then I said, oh, my son's birth mom is fair skinned like me. And right. His birth father is mixed, you know? So that's just like a natural part of my own soul DNA.
Right.
And just seeing people more, I know everyone. I know we have different skin colors. I honor that some people want to say that. So I'm not against however people want to have their freedom of speech. But I will tell you that I view people from a vibrational frequency, and I was drawn to your vibe. So I think, you know, I believe, you know, we all on our own ascension path. And I feel like good karma is an in vivo example of you going deep within your own soul and doing the healing work and really like looking at yourself in the mirror, but then having a blast, like integrating so many parts of your talents as a musician. I mean, were you just having so much fun with this album?
Yeah, it was really fun to make because it was coming from such a deep place. And I knew everything I did was right. This is the first time I've ever created art and felt like everything was right. I don't regret one thing. And this is the first time I've done an album. I'm like, man, I could have, I'm not sitting there like, man, I could have put that in that song or put this would have been dope if I used this kind of beat instead. This is the first, Good Karma is the first album I've made that I feel like is completely perfect.
Wow. Cheers to that. I love that.
It's because my heart and mind was in the right place. I had a therapist the whole time. I was fasting. I was doing the spiritual growth and development. And I'm not really religious, but I'm really heavy on God. You know, I'm really heavy in spirituality. And
I felt that.
Yeah.
That's why I reached out to you because I just pick up on things like intuitively, and I was touched by that music, Exotic Flowers, and I'll put the link, you know, into that as well as obviously your whole bio. But I felt the vibe, and I also felt like it was healing and it was empowering. And it was also about self-respect and self-love. And I felt boundaries, like boundaries needed to be had. Like, you know, like don't give it all away. Like really, you know, have your self-love and then have others respect you, but you respect them. So that's just what I felt.
Right.
And then I listened to the lyrics again, and then I was like, oh my goodness, maybe I was supposed to receive this song because I was supposed to interview you. That's exactly what I thought. That's how I interpret it.
Yeah, I know I'm talking too much on this thing, and we're kind of going long, but dude, it is a pleasure to be here with you. It really is. I'm glad that you did reach out and say something because, you know, right time, right place, everything, you know, like it was the right time. And, you know, I was just like thinking about doing and accepting some other podcasts. And then I seen yours and I was like, man, she seems pretty interesting that she would even want, you know, and, you know, on paper, you look different.
Oh, you, good. How do I look? Tell me how I look on paper.
On paper, you look very, very well groomed. You know, I'll say you look very, you know, almost very conservative, you know, like on paper, you look like that. You're not like that, but you look like that. And so I'm like, this would be interesting to get a dynamic like this. And then I meet you and you're just like me. And I'm like, oh man, she's not. I thought she was going to be way far out, extra, you know, no, not a cursing kind of person, not a wild at all kind of person. And you are a go-getter, I must say.
Thank you.
You are a go-getter. You are a inventor. You're a trailblazer. You're more than what I thought you were. Way more. And you're sweet. And you're nice and you're considerate and you care about people around you. I can tell. You have a great heart. You have a pure spirit. You know, that's why I accepted this.
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you. I'm just going to just do a mindful like pause and just try to learn how to take that in. You know, sometimes you think based on how you see someone present on social media or how, like you said, how I look so well groomed, but I just get so honored and inspired. Like, I'm like, oh my gosh, I was like a little kid. Like I really get very, very honored to meet. Like, I'm like, I get to hear about your journey and I want to know so much more. And so I just want to thank you for taking some time because you actually listened to a couple of my shows before we did this. And it's like, show and tell.
Yeah. What is the guy's name?
Charles Maddox.
There we go. He was really good. I enjoyed him.
I'll let him know. I'll give a shout out to Charles. Charles, we love you. You know, he's Bob Marley's nephew. So Bob Marley's giving you a kiss on the cheek too. Yeah.
That's Bob Marley's nephew.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Marley's nephew.
My father is Rastafarian. And
oh my gosh.
Reggae singer, four-time Grammy winner. He's played with the Marley family. He might know my father. My dad toured with Burning Spear, a band called Burning Spear. He'll know Burning Spear the moment you say Burning Spear.
Okay, you know, I will tell
my dad toured Burning Spear for 10 years.
Oh my God, I love it. Well, it was, he was part of Burning Spear. There's probably a reason why I did send that strategically, because I had intuition that it was the right interview to kind of show you. Yeah. So that's awesome. So let me just, I know I don't mind the time because time's timeless. People can, I want to just, can we talk about your number one bestseller, The Narcissist? I'd like, no, just to be honest. No.
My number one bestseller is the album, Good Karma.
Ah, album featuring Good Karma. The single Narcissist. Yeah,
right. Featuring Narcissist.
Wow.
Right. My number one bestseller is the album in top 10 on iTunes, which is a really big deal. And but it was you know, it did good independently. That was an independent push, all me by myself. So just imagine if I had any kind of extra funding behind me. Just imagine.
Just imagine how this is all going to keep unfolding.
Yeah,
because you're in that energy field. I call that the quantum field. So you've accessed another level of your own awareness. And that's also what inspired me. So the song inspired me. You inspired me. I hadn't read anything about you, and you didn't, like, you like were like, who are these two people? And that's also the beauty of, like, I just Instagram cold messaged you and I'm like, hi, it's Dr. Denise.
Right. And it was so cool because it was a voicemail. I was like, this is amazing. Who is this person? I was so happy that you did it like that. I was so happy. Because people do it and they text it because they're just trying to be respectful. And you are bold enough that I was like, there's no way I can't be around someone as bold as her. Like, I wasn't just trying to do a podcast. I'm like, I need her in my life too. Like,
I feel that way about you. I was like, getting that excited. So I had patients, and then I also had an appointment across town. And I was like, oh my God, I just met the coolest person. I was reading about you. Then I'm like, okay. And then I even told you, I'm like, oh my goodness, I want to listen to all your songs again. I'm going to again and again. So
yeah. This industry is very fickle that I'm in. So, you know, I have a deal on the table with Sony right now that I haven't even signed yet. I'm not even supposed to be talking about this. I don't know. I have a deal on this table with Sony. The contract's in the email right now. I can sign it now. Like, I have a deal with Sony right now on the table because the success of this album independently. They couldn't believe it. They were like, we've been looking for you, you know, like literally looking for artists just like you. Like, so, and I don't even know if I want to sign it. You know, I'm still negotiating it. So it's just kind of thing.
I have an idea, because I want to have everyone find out where they can find you. And then I want to talk with you off call and just get to know you more.
Yeah.
But sure. I just want to tell you that I am incredibly inspired, not just by, like, your entire being, your story, your healing, and the power of your voice, not just as the music, but everything about you helping people come out of poverty, coming out of prison. I mean, your story, I mean, I just am honored. Just let me tell you, just thank you. I'm just going to shush myself now. I'm incredibly honored, and I'm excited to see where our friendship goes in your career and how many people you're going to inspire in your lifetime. So thank you for your music. Thank you for your voice. Definitely. And thank you for our time tonight.
Definitely. I'm so glad I got a chance to be here. Thank you very much. It was an honor and a privilege, and the pleasure is all mine.
So where can everyone find you, Jay French? I'm going to put the bio on the link, but tell everyone where they can find me in the universe and listen to you.
You can find me in the universe somewhere. My nickname is Silver Surfer.
Okay.
Just look up. Look up.
You can find me in the universe, everyone. Goodbye. Mic drop.
Surfing the universe.
I just pictured you saying the universe and then the drop, the mic drop.
Look up. That's the universe. That's when I'll drop the mic. Look up. Everyone looks up. I'm out of there.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Thank you, Jay French. I'm going to have you on for more shows. Thank you.
Definitely. Definitely.